We get things underway in this second hour, talking a little love and romance. Our friend writer Colin Fleming joins us, the man who I like to say is just too stubborn to ever be governed by enforced insanity. Hello, Colin.
Oh, I am the storm, my romantic radio valentine.
Greetings, my cherub. How are you?
All right, hanging in there.
Well, you want to look at a couple of areas and talk about love and romance. And well, let's start with Keats. Has there ever been a more romantic poet?
There have probably been more romantic poets in the sense of, oh, I would like to pitch sweet woo to you and hold your hand and romance you all the livelong day. But in terms of understanding the entire gamut of love, from its ceiling of transcendence to its nadir of just vivisecting you alive, I would say Keats is going to be our Cupid with the ready bucket of arrows on this particular deck, yes.
Well, and you've written all about that new piece in the Washington Post this week.
Yeah, so that, what it deals in is a number of things and how they come together. And one of those things is Keats meeting Fanny Braun, who was a neighbor of his, in the fall of 1818. And he thought, this is going to be awesome. Love this girl. Brilliant. Perfect love story, all of that. He gets into the next year, and his consumption, which a lot of people had at the time, and which Keats had a pretty good idea was going to kill him at some point, really started to catch up with him. And 1819, if you're not a massive Keatsian, I'm sure many of you regular downtown listeners are, but nonetheless, not to be didactic, 1819 is his big year when he is basically going to have this annus mirabilis of creation that we can put up there with a number of years in artistic history. We could go with the Beatles in 1963, Shakespeare in 1599, and sleep on the one I had last year. But it's sort of this year where he writes all of these odes that are pretty much what we know Keats for. And one of the poems he writes, too, is called La Belle Dame Sans Merci. And that's what the Washington Post piece was about, where it's sort of this tale of, it's almost vampiric, really, in a sense, where this knight, this guy's going through the woods, and he comes across a knight sitting there, and the knight's on the ground, like in the trail, and he's all disheveled, and something really strange has happened here. And the passerby says to him, dude, what's up? And this person sitting on the ground proceeds to unburden himself of this encounter he just had. And it encapsulates what Keats was going through when he knew he had to speed up his life because he knew he was on the clock and his time was finite in terms of writing his name into the firmament of poets, of the all-time great artists. And he also knew, because he was a noble person, that he wouldn't really be able to have a life with Fanny Braun, and he did not want to embroil her in something that was going to be star-crossed. So he writes this ballad, basically, and I think we can read it because it's not especially long. And what you'll notice is I get to the third line of each stanza, there's a little catch in my voice. It's because of the syncopation, this extra beat that Keats puts into it. And it is a very amatory poem. So if you think I'm saying something completely debauched and salacious on the air without swearing, I am. So let your imagination go completely wild with this. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, alone and palely loitering? The sedge is withered from the lake, and no birds sing. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, so haggard and so woe begone? The squirrel's granary is full, and the harvest done. I see a lily on thy brow with anguish moist and fever dew, and on thy cheeks a fading rose fast withereth too. I met a lady in the meads, full beautiful, a fairy's child. Her hair was long, her foot was light, and her eyes were wild. I made a garland for her head and bracelets too and fragrant zone. She looked at me as she did love and made sweet moan. I set her on my pacing steed and nothing else saw all day long. For sidelong would she bend and sing a fairy song. She found me roots of relish sweet and honey wild and manna dew, and sure in language strange she said, I love thee true. She took me to her elfin grot, and there she wept and sighed full sore. And there I shut her wild, wild eyes with kisses four. And there she lulled me asleep, and there I dreamed, ah, woe betide, the latest dream I ever dreamed on the cold hillside. I saw pale kings and princes too, pale warriors, death pale were they all. They cried, La Belle Dame sans merci, thee hath in thrall. I saw their starved lips in the gloam with horrid warning gaped wide, and I awoke and found me here on the cold hillside. And this is why I sojourn here, alone and palely loitering, though the sedge is withered from this lake and no birds sing. Boom, Valentine's, right?
Man, you don't have to be Fellini to pick up the subtext in that.
No. For instance, the steed is more like a rooster.
Mm,
I think we can make that pun.
Yes.
And the word choice, you have to note something like the word sojourn. Now, that's a very powerful, often sort of neglected verb. We sojourn when we are young and we have had our first kiss at the eighth grade social that night and we are in bed and we are ruminating on what happened earlier. We sojourn later when we find the person that we think we're going to spend our entire life with, and we have that day when we know this and we are sitting there with our own thoughts and we're luxuriating in them. And that's what this knight is doing. So this guy basically shows up and there's like, I mean, for all of this going on, there's like condoms on the ground and everything. This guy's been abducted and had this trice. And the visitor's like, come on, dude, get up and move. And no, I'm going to hang out amidst everything for a little bit and gather myself. I've had a very potent, powerful experience.
And by the way, you are also right in your Washington Post piece about Ode to a Nightingale. The relationship with the woman that introduced that to me many years ago ended rather quickly, but the memories linger on.
F. Scott Fitzgerald remarked that he could not read Ode to a Nightingale, which he had committed to memory, without crying. In fact, a recording even exists of him trying to get through it. Not many people know that. You can go on YouTube. You can find it. And it is, I think, the best poem anyone has ever written, with the exception maybe of John Clare's I Am, which we've also touched on in this program. But it doesn't quite have that sing-song ballad quality of La Belle Dame sans merci. But yeah, if you just want straight-up emotionalism and to feel human and alive and to just have that potency, that pain even, that heartbreakedness course through your very hemoglobin, that would be a good poem to turn to.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. We also want to touch on Bob Dylan's, even for a guy who said his songs were not autobiographical, Blood on the Tracks sure seems like his most personal album.
I believe that it was not autobiographical in the sense that he meant that. I always balk when people say to me, oh, this happened in your life, in this short story, this book you wrote. It's like, no, it didn't. You in-house your experience, and you write from within a feeling of something that might have happened to you. But the better you are as an artist, the more you overleap your own actual experiences. So it's not experiential. It might be drawing on your emotion. Now, he actually said, he was probably just being a wise ass, that he was influenced with this album by the stories of Chekhov. Really easy to kind of just say, yeah, you know, Chekhov put me up to this. It's sort of a nice cop-out. But I don't think it was sort of this delineation of his marriage coming apart as he was seeing somebody else. I think it was an attempt to codify heartbreak in LP form. And Dylan was remonstrative of people who said they loved this album, because he said, what's wrong with you? Why would you like that much pain? But I get what he did. It's an album that's largely a blues, but it's an ultramarine. It's like it's ground from lapis lazuli. And that ultramarine quality is the melody quality. It's a very tuneful album. And that is what allows the pill to go down, so to speak. So I wrote a book called The Anglerfish Comedy Troupe, Stories from the Abyss. And it was kind of my Blood on the Tracks, but I think it was even more gutting, going through horrible things in my life. But there were stories where you had something like the Char Paper Blues Band, and it was about to try this. It was about like a matchbook cover and a piece of candy wrapper. And these little characters formed a band that blew around on the wind, and they would play the soundtrack for whatever what was going on in your life. It was like crackling fire sounds when you told someone that you were with, that you wanted to be with them forever or have a divorce. And it was very whimsical, and there's a lot of humor in it. And that's what I used for my particular pill. So with Dylan, if you think about something like Tangled Up in Blue, very whistleable. It's very hummable. And he's talking about a poet from the 13th century. It's like, who do you think that is? It's obviously Dante going into the Inferno. But when Dante goes into the Inferno, he's like, oh, Beatrice, I love you. You're like my idea of ultimate love. And so you have that kind of syncretic pooling of heartbreak and love, the loss you felt, the love you hope to have again.
Also, the new collection out, the latest in the Bootleg series, More Blood, More Tracks, a lot of different takes, and some undiscovered gems as well on that.
Sure. Lots of outtakes, lots of early versions and everything. Now, there is a song on there that you referenced at the beginning of our talk called Up to Me. It had been squirreled away on the Biograph collection years ago, but it's out now in more sort of open terms, basically. And when Dylan did this album, people didn't really like it in his group. They thought it kind of sucked. So he asked like Mike Bloomfield, the guitarist from like back in 1955, to play on it. And he plays the songs for him. He's like, this is what I have. Bloomfield comes away thinking that they're all long, they're all in the same key, and they all sound alike.
Right.
Not really what you're going for, but he had this sort of palette, I feel. He wanted to dial into a specific color of it. And I was listening to Up to Me again today, and if Dylan had written no other songs, and he didn't even release this on the proper album, you would have this on the short list of best songs ever. There's something very powerful about being hurt. We always think that the person who hurts us wins, but once they've done whatever they've done, and again, I'm not like referencing autobiography with Dylan here, because who knows what his marriage was like. The person who is the heartbroken is ultimately the decider, and they're going to decide how far they're going to move on and overhaul themselves from what has happened to them. The other person's already done their bit. So I think oftentimes in life, the people who get hurt more tend to be the people who grow more. And Up to Me is a song about resting back control. And when you listen to a stanza like, if I'd thought about it, I never would have done it. I guess I would have let it slide. If I'd lived my life by what others were thinking, the heart inside of me would have died. I was just too stubborn to ever be governed by enforced insanity. Someone had to reach for the rising star. I guess it was up to me. Like, okay, artist, you have a mighty crown, and you have dashed that corona on the ground and challenged us to try to pick it up. And we heard the Sermon on the Mount, and I knew it was too complex. It didn't amount to anything more than what the broken glass reflects. When you bite off more than you can chew, you pay the penalty. Somebody's got to tell the tale. I guess it must be up to me. And that's where the artist always wins, because it's the artist ultimately who has final say. And it's an album about, and this is a song about, reclaiming what that final say is going to be. So it's very empowering for all of the heartbreaker things.
Yeah, and it's great. So now Buckets of Rain is a fine song. And that apparently is what Dylan chose instead of Up to Me, which was also quite a bit longer as well.
It was. I think Up to Me runs to like six and a half minutes. And the one that stood in for it is, it's very bluesy. And I think he had to do that because you didn't want the album to be too dirgy. And when you just have like the acoustic guitar and it's just kind of you, like if you think about the second side of Bringing It All Back Home, like it's good. But the four songs, kind of like a proto Tangled Up in Blue, right? With more logorrhea, more of the four-syllable words rhyming with each other and that kind of thing. But Gates of Eden, It's All Right, Ma. Like, you wouldn't want too much of it in one place, though. And I think he had to make sure to put that tunefulness into it, to get some electric instrumentation into it and to round out the sound of the album. And then subsequently, Forevermore, people always say, as part of the hype machine by trying to manufacture something rather than going with the actual reality, it's Dylan's best album since Blood on the Tracks. And I would think that that must drive him crazy.
I have no doubt there. Colin Fleming, you can check out his recent piece on Keats in the Washington Post. And, of course, go to ColinFlemingLit.com and see all of his work there. Colin, always a pleasure. Thank you, my friend. Let's do it again next week.
Sounds good.